You're listening to Dottotech. Hi, I'm Steve Dotto, and you're listening to Dottotech. Our show's dedicated to helping you get the most out of your technology wherever you use it, be that at home, at school, or at work. We've got a great show lined up today. We're going to be talking to Merlin Horton. Merlin is the executive director of the Safe Online Outreach Society. For years, Merlin has been working with kids at risk online, discovering the sorts of activities that they're doing on the internet that could be putting them at risk, and helping them out and helping educate parents and caregivers, teachers, that sort of people, helping us to understand the issues that kids are facing in the online world. So Merlin's going to be giving us some terrific advice in that area. We've also got Rick Yeager, our Mac expert, on. We're going to be talking about the Flashback Trojan. It's out there. It's the first of the viruses that are kind of hitting the Mac. Well, there have been viruses before, but this is the first real mainstream virus that's hitting the Mac. It's a pretty scary virus, actually, so Rick will fill us in on that. As well, Paul DeMera is going to be joining us. We're going to be talking Slingbox, Google Drive, and he's just bought himself a nice pair of glasses on Clearly Contacts, his first online ocular shopping experience. Is that the right term for it? Ocular shopping? At any rate, buying glasses online, and Paul quite enjoyed that, so he wants to chat about that with us as well. So we, as I say, we have a terrific show lined up. It's been a pretty busy week in the world of technology. Probably the biggest news, Google Drive being released. Google Drive is a competitor for the cloud-based storage systems, Dropbox certainly being the biggest and most well-known of that particular type of product. So Google Drive has just been released, and Paul will be talking to us about that. I wanted to remind everybody that we have one more week of our big Slingbox giveaway. We're giving away a Slingbox HD, the top-end TV sharing technology. The Slingbox is a device that you plug into your cable connection. You can also connect it to your PVR, and it allows you to then stream your own TV signal to your computer for free, or to your devices like your iPhone, iPad, Android, tablet. You have to purchase an app for those in order to stream to those devices, but you can stream in your home, or you can actually stream and tunnel into your own TV signal if you're somewhere else. If you happen to be in Mexico and you want to watch the hockey game, you can watch the hockey game on your feed. Slingbox, a brilliant idea. Joining me online now, Merlin Horton. Merlin is the executive director for the Safe Online Outreach Society, and she is one of my go-to people for all things about child safety online. How are you doing, Merlin?
I'm doing excellent, Steve. Thank you.
Good. You're enjoying canoeing today.
I was out for a paddle on Hassock Lake this morning. It was a spectacular morning.
Good, good. Now, listen, I wanted to kind of get an update from you on what's happening online. For, I don't know, maybe 5 years now, 6 years now, you've been one of my real good advisors, filling me in on what kids are doing online, what activities they're doing that puts them at risk. And so I thought maybe we could have a chat, find out exactly what kids are doing these days, and maybe not just kids, but everybody's doing online to kind of put themselves at risk.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, you know, I think we can run the gamut on this one. Gaming. I have some concerns about gaming recently that, you know, I'd love to, you know, be able to get across to your viewers. Going into elementary schools, we see a lot of young people now, as low as grade 3, actually, on our recent trip to Prince George. We're doing high school assemblies for kids grade 3 to grade 12 now. And we're really seeing in that elementary school population a lot of kids playing mature and teen games without any real parental restriction on it.
Now, these games that you're talking about the not just online, I mean console games as well as computer games, correct?
Yeah, actually the majority is console gaming, and that's a big problem too, because parents, well, they'll look at the internet and go, oh, we have to be really careful what they do there. Parents aren't aware of how connected being on a console is, and how diverse and complex those online communities are, and how much of an emotional impact they can have on a young person.
And these games, increasingly these games, and when they say for mature audience, they mean for mature audience, because the game designers are not designing them for even teenagers. They're designing them for adults.
Yeah, the absolutely. The worldwide market for gaming is huge, particularly in Southeast Asia. I mean, they have three television stations in Korea just dedicated to World of Warcraft. There's huge industry around it. They're now recruiting, you know, kids out of high school and putting them in kind of these training camps as gamers to get them to these, you know, high levels of gaming. So there's public industry interest, there's money involved. And yeah, these are adult games meant for adults.
Now, I guess it was a few years ago that it kind of first came to light to me. It was the was it Need for Speed? I'm trying to remember which game it was where they you would gain points. The first one that was I found really like, holy cow, are they ever getting offensive? Was when you would beat up a prostitute for money in one of these games. Grand Theft. That's the franchise, Grand Theft Auto, and but that's now 5 or 6 years ago that kind of that barrier was broken. What sort of activities do you know? What are we exposing our kids to if we're not watching very closely what these games have?
Well, I think blood and gore to a certain degree has limits on what kids should see. We can I don't think that kids confuse real life. I'm not saying that kids confuse real life in gaming. I don't think that they, you know, think, oh, I can kill somebody in a game, so, you know, I can go out and do it. And the whole argument about increased violence of young people because they game is not borne up by the research or empirical evidence. So I don't think that it has an impact in that it leads kids to be more violent. I think it does lead them to be, you know, desensitized to those images and just developmentally kids' capacities to deal with images at grade 3 is not comparable to an adult. Right, just the graphic nature of whether there's adult, you know, situations such as, you know, stealing cars and beating up sex trade workers in Grand Theft Auto, or it's, you know, the kind of competitive team play that you have to get in some sort of first person shooter where you're part of a guild and you have to hold your own socially.
Now, is that an increasing issue as well? I know that we've talked a lot about bullying in the past, and bullying is especially prevalent amongst girls in the online world. But there was certainly a movement and kind of a direction that boys in the online world through the console gaming were starting to get into more socially difficult situations.
Oh, absolutely. Little kids will get rolled for their money. Older players will just, if they're in some sort of team play, will actually shoot their own player if they know it's some little kid, just to get them out of the way. And so these things, you know, may sound like, oh, yeah, you're in a game, you get shot, and, you know, whatever. But kids get invested.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, and if there's emotional harm, if there's psychological harm, if there's, you know, financial harm, and you know, that'll happen too. Kids will, you know, coerce somebody else into giving them in-game money, or there's all sorts of social manipulation that are beyond the capacity of a 10-year-old to manage.
I'll never forget how devastated my 12-year-old son was when his Diablo account got hacked many years ago. He had spent so many hours building and getting the different items that, you know, that he was trying to collect as he worked his way up through the levels in this game, and his account got hacked and cleaned out, and he was absolutely devastated for about a week.
They have tremendous emotional investment in the game, and that reminds me that I often get asked by parents, you know, I can't get my kid off his game. Well, sometimes I turn to parents and say, you need to be aware of how invested your kid is in their games. And rather than have this whole parent, you know, child conflict over, you have to get off right now, I told you you had to be off. You need to talk to that kid and say, why is it that you can't come off in 10 minutes? I had that conversation with my son. He said, Mom, if I leave now, 10 of my guys will die. And I have to face them tomorrow when I come back into this game.
So getting understanding a little bit more of exactly what they're dealing with is going to be beneficial.
Absolutely. Get it. Just like you wouldn't leave your kids socially alone at a party of all sorts of age people and, you know, and not want to walk them through that or introduce them to people or show them how to have social, social manners.
Yeah, understanding the social mores of the online world is something that's beyond most adults if we're not game playing. So paying attention, asking the kids about what, you know, about those sorts of things will give us a lot better picture of what they're facing.
What is it that, what social media need is that meeting for them? Who are they in relationship with in that game? Yeah, and what does that relationship mean to them? And what are, you know, yeah, go ahead.
Even if, you know, well, maybe you shouldn't be starting to play a game then at 8 o'clock at night if you can't get off within 2 hours. Maybe you better start at 7 o'clock or not at all.
Yeah. And go through that negotiation. I understand that you need at least two hours to play this game. So how are we going to manage your schedule?
Because exactly.
This is an absolute here at a bedtime or whatever it is.
What about kids in some of the other newer social media tools in areas? I keep thinking about Twitter and you know some of the more mobile social platforms.
Twitter has been just a big shock to me in the last year, just since this school year.
Why is that?
Because so many young people are using it. I really didn't see it as a social network that was going to attract young people.
Like me, you had trouble getting the whole Twitter thing.
Yeah. Why do I want to follow the Kardashians, really?
Yes, which I don't.
Yeah, I don't either.
Kids are engaging in Twitter. I have trouble figuring out how a lot of adults engage. How are kids using it?
Well, the kids are, they're following the Kardashians. That's one of my lines from the assembly. Who here has Twitter and who's following the Kardashians? And there's this kind of, you know, knowing giggle that goes through.
Yeah.
But kids are also using it as thought leaders in their social groups. So I'll ask young people, you know, I was in a Maple Ridge High School and I asked 350 kids, who here has a Twitter account? Well, you know, about 200 of them had a Twitter account. These are older teens, mind you, grade 10 to grade 12. So 200 have a Twitter account, 50 have more than 100 followers, and 5 in that, out of that, you know, that group have more than 300 followers on Twitter.
That's a lot.
That really intrigues me. You know, these are the thought leaders in those schools.
Now, what sort of a relationship can a an early teen have with 300 people following them? I mean, we've always talked about with Facebook, you know, one of the tenets that we give parents is face-to-face friends only. It's only people that you know and you can identify personally that should be your friend on Facebook. That's probably not the case in Twitter. So why would they be gathering this many followers, first of all?
Well, I think that teens, you know, appreciate the power of influence as much as anyone.
Mm-hmm.
That it's a form of social acceptance. And, you know, there's always been the pecking order. And part of the pecking order is now how many followers do you have? How many people do you have listening to what you have to say on a given day?
Now, I would think that this would be the ideal grounds for the class clown.
Yep.
I wish I'd had it because I was the class clown.
One-liners coming out of you.
Oh, I've got them. I've got them. And if I could be firing them off and not have the teacher actually hear me, I would have been in heaven.
Well, and that brings up an interesting point because I keep thinking, why aren't the teachers listening to this?
Yeah.
Because if you have 5 people that have the influence of, you know, 600, 900 people in your school, why are you bringing them in saying, let's have a conversation because I'm acknowledging that you're, you know, you have some influence in this school, and I'd like to include you in some dialogue about how we can make this a better school.
Yeah, even for as part of the kind of the soft infrastructure of communication within the school, you know, don't forget that, you know, next week we've got this happening at the school.
Absolutely.
Engaging them in some of the process. That's an interesting and kind of intimidating thought that we now have to extend our parenting skills into Twitter.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, thanks for that, Merlin.
But that's not any different than I've been talking to you about for years, which is in order to role model appropriate values and conduct in online environments, we have to be there.
Yes.
We can't just say, yes, I know my kid's somewhere in cyberspace, but I don't really understand cyberspace, so I'm not going.
The internet's a place. It's not a thing.
It's not a, yeah. Yes. The infospheres.
Yes. Okay, so we've got kids. We've got dealing with the game environment. We've got dealing with the Twitter environment. Talk to me about porn.
Porn. You know, I've always been a sex educator for a very long time, and have always wanted young people to have appropriate sexual health information. And I'm kind of seeing a crisis coming up now in that, you know, young people seeking out images, perhaps sexual images, when they start to hit puberty, are no longer just confined to, you know, National Geographic and maybe the occasional airbrushed Penthouse magazine. That that young teens, particularly boys, will use the internet to seek out sexual images. And my concern is
And the internet, frankly, seeks them out as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Inadvertent exposure to explicit images is happening. You know, the statistics say the average age of exposure, first exposure to internet porn is 11 in Canada.
Oh.
So they're seeing these images and they don't, again, don't have the developmental capacity to put them in context. They haven't seen sex before. And so these are becoming kind of the instructive resources that they're finding in the absence of adults willing to have, you know, pretty clear, explicit conversations with them.
Yes.
So they're learning about sex and, you know, and porn doesn't teach about healthy sex, you know.
No.
Porn teaches that sex is a performance, that that it doesn't place much value on intimacy or relationship. It portrays sex as a mechanical act, not a sharing of intimacies between people. And kids role model what they first see. And I have concerns about the sexual health of our young people.
This is just the generations that have been first exposed to this are just kind of passing through early adulthood now. So we're probably starting to see the ramifications in our adult space.
Yeah. And, you know, I had a young man come to one of my workshops in Smithers last winter. And he made a huge impact on me. He told me this story. He said that he, you know, started to become sexually active or, you know, at least aware before the internet. Mm-hmm. And so he had some girly magazines and then the internet came and he discovered internet porn and he thought it was the best thing since sliced toast.
Okay.
And he watched porn all through his adolescence and became, he's a very computer savvy young man. He's into filmmaking. He's into all sorts of digital technologies. And at 21, he got offered a job for a day filming a porn movie. And he said, you know, he thought he'd died and gone to heaven. And he went that day, and he filmed for the entire day. And he said he had never experienced a more depressing day in his life.
Hmm.
That it was boring, that it was disconnected, that the people were uninteresting and uninterested, that it was the least sexual thing he had ever seen. And he made the school administrators in the room choke. But he said, I think that, you know, people who film porn should go out and talk to high school students and tell them what the reality of the porn industry is.
Mm. It was so jaded because it was such a hollow experience.
It was so hollow for him. But there was a young man who had, you know, had kind of been, had accepted it and seen it as, you know, okay, this is okay. You know, there's no problem with this. This is people having sex. And then kind of got looked behind the veil, at least a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned to me in your email that there's a hormone that we produce or something that we produce called oxytocin,
mm-hmm.
which is produced when we're in intimate moments and people are starting to now relate that more to their computer screens than to another individual.
Yeah, it's called relational impotence, actually. Relational impotence, and it describes a condition where people are then unable to actually attain sexual arousal when in the physical presence of another person, but only feel sexual when viewing a screen.
And that's just because they're just in the habit of the screen being the place.
Not just a habit, but the oxytocin, which is that pleasure hormone.
Mm-hmm.
Reinforces every experience online. The oxytocin is, they call it, you know, our bonding hormone, or it connects us with those intimate moments and the person in them. So birth is when oxytocin is released, breastfeeding and during sexual arousal and intimacy. So when these people are experiencing those hormones while viewing the screen, that reptilian part of their brain is looking for somebody to bond with. It's the, you know, where do I get the cuddle? mm-hmm. that comes with that hormone, and there isn't one. And so then often they get caught up in a cycle of, okay, I'm going to find more porn again. I want to do that. I'm going to masturbate again. And more porn. And so it becomes a problem for more people than I think many people realize.
Now, as far as dealing with our kids, we know that we can't shelter them from the porn. Mm-hmm. We know that blocking sites are not going to work. Yeah. Is this just a case that we have to expect our kids to grow up so much younger than we did and be able, and we have to start dealing with them straight up way earlier than was our experience in our youth?
Yeah, well, I think we have to start dealing with them straight up. I think we have to be honest with what we think about pornography. And that's up to each individual family to make that comment.
Mm-hmm.
But what do we think about porn? Not what does Merlin Horton think or what does Steve Dotto think, but what does our family think about pornography? I think it means that we also need to make sure that they do have access always to medically and academically reliable information about sexual health.
Mm.
You know, Sexuality and You is a website run by the Canadian Association of Obstetricians and Gynecologists.
Okay.
Options for Sexual Health, Won't Get Weird. A great website will answer any question that a youth has about sex, even if they're too shy to ask an adult or, and you know, unfortunately, a lot of kids learn about sex not only, mostly from their peers.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
At least this is a counter to that. They can go and look it up and reference something reliable.
Because it's still not going to be a comfortable conversation for, I would say 85 or 90% of adults are going to have an issue talking about it with their kids. But absolutely. It is one that we do need to overcome if we possibly can. The thing is, we don't want to make our kids feeling equally as uncomfortable. We have to find a way to make it acceptable to both sides in the equation.
Yeah. And I think we can start early, too, before kids hit adolescence or puberty, and say things like, look after your eyes. You know, there's things that you can see that you can't unsee. I've done a lot of research, and I've, inadvertently been exposed to illegal images of child pornography, and I can't unsee those, Steve.
Mm.
It makes a big impact on us, and I think we should give our kids a head up that you have to be your own filter now. Acknowledge we can't filter the internet for you, but I'd really like it if you take care and think twice before you click on something that says, body smashed in and, brains and guts sticking out.
Yeah.
Because it probably is. In my day, that link wouldn't have been true. It would have been like, yeah, really, there's not anything there, because we couldn't get those images now.
No, but now they're accessible to all of us.
Yep.
It's getting more and more complex to be a parent or to be a leader in society, but Merlin Horton is one of the people that guides us through. Her website is at solos.ca? It's solos.ca.
www.safeonlineoutreach.com.
Safeonlineoutreach.com. Yes. Merlin Horton is Executive Director of the Safe Online Outreach Society. Merlin, thanks so much for your time. We'll do this again soon, okay?
Thanks, Steve. You rock.
Okay. Paul DeMera joins me now. How are you keeping, Paul?
Doing really well, actually, Steve.
Now, Paul, you're my go-to guy for all things mobility, but you know what we've got that we're giving away on the show this week is a sling box, and you've spent a fair bit of time with a sling box.
Actually, I probably had it for now, 3 or 4 years, I guess. And
so you were way back in the first, well, I guess it was probably, yeah, the first iteration.
Yeah, I had the original series from Sling, and it was really impressive back then, but it's just gotten better over the years as they've improved the product.
By saying impressive, do you mean unbelievably difficult to configure the very first version?
Well, it was challenging, let's put it that way. You had to pretty much know how to set up something called port forwarding on your router, which is somewhat painful for most people who are not experienced in doing that.
Not so second nature. And I bet you even had a challenge.
I had to figure it out. I actually had to read the manual.
Yeah.
You don't like to have to do that, right?
That's. But they have changed significantly. The new version, you've got the HD now. How long have you had that one?
I've had that for probably, about 2 years-ish now?
Oh, okay. So that long. So and it was a snap to set up, wasn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. The new one has a whole bunch of enhancements, including, if your router's plug-and-play compatible where it'll automatically set up stuff, it will do that for you once you set the box up. So
in almost any of the newer routers that's going to work with?
Pretty much, yeah.
Now, what do you find you use it for?
Well, interestingly enough, there's two fundamental reasons I use it. One is for around the house. I use it with the client that's on my iPad, so I can watch television that I would normally get on a TV set anywhere in the house. And I can do it on my iPhone, my iPad. You can do it on now. I see they have an Android tablet client. So there's all these clients they have for the different devices.
Now help me out. That's not so you can keep watching the hockey game in the bathroom, is it?
Well, no, not really. No, it just means that if you want to sit outside, for instance, or do something else other than sit in front of the television set, you can put it anywhere you like.
And also, if the TV is being monopolized by another member of the family, then you can still probably watch hockey if that's what's
exactly. It's really cool. It also works with the newer PVRs and boxes like that. So if you want a remote control, let's say you have a Telus box or a Jaw box or one of the other boxes out there that's a DVR, digital video recorder, you can remote control that from the Slingbox client, and that's really cool as well.
So it gives you the ability to record a show if you forgot that you want to record your favorite show, that sort of thing.
Yeah, you can talk to the box and do different things with it. Yeah.
So now...
That was one use. The second use is basically being mobile. So I travel a little bit, and if I'm, say, for instance, up at my place up in the Okanagan, I can, basically have a wireless connection and still watch the same TV channels that I'm used to watching at home because I know what channels the shows are on and what time shows come on. So you're really able to place shift where you watch television outside of your home as long as you have a wireless connection or a Wi-Fi connection.
Have you been able to get a sense of what the important link is as far as quality? Is it the uplink from your home to the network, or is it the downlink from where you are to the device?
Generally speaking, both are obviously important. Downlink tends to be better for most different services that you have, whether it's wireless or wired. So the uplink is really your bottleneck. I have a link that's around 500 kilobits per second, so that gives me reasonable quality when I'm outside of the house, but it doesn't give me HD. When I'm roaming around in the house, because I'm on my own Wi-Fi router, it jumps up to like 6 or 7 megabits per second, and the video quality is it's high definition, 720p or 1080i, right? So depending on what you feed your Slingbox.
And so knowing what your upload speed is from your service provider is going to tell you pretty much what the quality is going to be like when you're downstream, when you're at the cabin, or if you're at Starbucks and you've got kind of their low volume bandwidth, you're not going to get a super feed through.
It looks really good on the iPad or the iPhone, but yeah, you're not going to get high definition per se. Yeah. It's going to be slightly lower resolution, but very watchable and certainly enjoyable.
Well, of course, we think about this so much in Canada as hockey, and I have to ask you to quote your. I saw your status update on Facebook after the, and it was my favorite of all of the statuses after our team, the Canucks, lost. You want to tell it?
Yeah, it goes along the lines of, I want to make sure that when I die, the Canucks are my pallbearers so they can let me down for the last time. Darn, yeah, I was kind of disappointed with Game 5 there.
Well, now we've got lots of time to talk about technology and other things. Now, the big news this week is Google Drive has been released, and Google going, there's a whole bunch of different cloud-based storage and virtual drive companies out there, and Google has stepped right into that hornet's nest. You've been playing with it?
Yeah, you get 5 gigs for free, first of all, so lots of storage. That's a whole lot of files. And I've just been initially trying it on my Mac computer. So I've set up my desktop, which is a Mac Mini, and a couple of my Mac Airs with the client. And it's great because it shows up as just another place to put files. So let's say you create an Excel document or a PowerPoint or whatever. You just basically either save it directly to the location and it shows it as Google Drive, or you can just drag and drop stuff right into the area. And then it automatically will replicate to the other devices once they're turned on. So if they're off, it obviously won't replicate, but once they're turned on, it will.
So it's got some features that go beyond Dropbox in the replication, I guess. Is that the syncing?
Yeah, the best part is the fact that you have one place to put everything, and whatever device you're using, you effectively will have that file available to that device wherever you are, as long as you have some form of internet connectivity, whether it be 3G, 4G, whatever, or a Wi-Fi connection, or your home system, whatever you've got, it'll just clone it to everything, including handheld devices. So
I've been using two different services myself. I use Dropbox a lot. Dropbox is, I think, essential if you have an iPad. It's at least up to this point, it's been the way to get documents into and be able to edit them while you're on the iPad.
Right.
And the other one that I've been using is one called SugarSync, which has a lot of those same features that you're talking about in Google Drive, is that it allows me to set up a SugarSync folder, and it syncs all of my common files between all of my different machines. So I've got three different machines, a PC and two Macs, and they all have the same common documents and all that sort of stuff, because SugarSync makes sure that, and it's also got them on the cloud, so it makes sure that they're all in all places at the same time. Do you use Dropbox?
I haven't really used it. I've played with it a little bit, but I really haven't spent a lot of time with it.
So you're impressed with Google Drive, but you haven't spent a lot of time with Dropbox. So you're not really in a position to say, because I think that's going to be the conversation people have
exactly.
on an ongoing basis, is what's it going to do that Dropbox doesn't? Because people have really embraced Dropbox as the dominant player in this space.
I think if you're using Google as, you know, more than just a search engine, and you're starting to use some of the Google apps along with Google, the nice thing about the Google solution is they're all integrated. So you can share files and everything's available. And, you know, I don't think they have the iPad client out yet.
But no, it's not out yet.
Remember what I was reading, it will be out shortly. So that'll give you even another level of flexibility.
And it's a little bit confusing, to me at least, but Google has decided to rename the Google apps Google Drive.
Right.
So now they're kind of naming all these things under this, you know, it's kind of like Microsoft used to do with the word Explorer. Everything is going to be Explorer.
Yeah.
So now everything is going to be Google Drive. So your Google Docs are going to be all Google Drive, but there's going to be a difference, because all of your normal documents that you store in Google Drive, you can see on all of your devices, but any of your Google Docs that you store on the Google Drive are only available in the cloud. They're not available in your local machine. So I think they're going to have a little bit of confusion.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of is available on your machine if you just navigate to that directory.
As long as you're online.
As long as you're online, absolutely. And it's synced, right?
So. Yeah, but the rest of your stuff will be available on your computer because you've got a home folder on your computer as well.
Right.
So that's where I think people are going to get a little bit confused as they start using.
There's a learning curve, for sure. Yeah. There's a learning curve. I mean, I used to use a USB drive. That's why I didn't use Dropbox. I had a 32 gig stick, right? But this is significantly more convenient because you don't have to, you know, plug something in or do anything. It's always ready to go as long as you have an internet connection. And I'm all about simplicity. So.
And I might have actually misspoke. I think I said Google Apps. Google Docs is being renamed Google Drive. So that's going to be a pretty interesting process as they move ahead with that. But I like their pricing. Have you checked out the pricing if you decide to upgrade?
I haven't yet. It looks like it's probably going to be really good based on the little bit of press release stuff I read.
Yeah,
I've got to know more about that than I do at this point.
Let me just look it up.
It's quite reasonable. I mean, 5 gigs is more than enough for most people to get started.
Well, it is until you start using it to share photos.
Yeah.
And photos is where it's really going to... I think it's going to take off in the whole photo world.
That's a whole other story. I actually take lower resolution pictures than, like, my camera will do 18, but I only take like 4 or 3, right? Just because, you know, you're going to put it on a screen and it's only 1080p is 2 megapixels,
speaking,
so you don't really need the extra resolution unless you're going to print huge prints, which not a lot of folks do these days. So that's one way to save a little space, I suppose, is just don't take huge pictures, right?
Yeah. So here's the Google Drive pricing matrix. Let me see. I just caught it up. So it's actually really aggressive. For $250 a month, you get 25 gigabytes of storage. And then if you go up to $5 a month, which is $60 a year, you get 100 gigabytes of drive space. And they've got it going all the way up to terabytes of drive space.
I mean, 100 gigs, my goodness, that's an awful lot of storage, even for photos.
Well, when you think about it, you know, it is if you're just doing documents and in some photos. If you're getting into doing a lot of video or audio files and stuff like that, you could fill that up pretty quickly. But for the average user who is just a consumer of normal apps, you know, some pictures, so, you know, a couple home videos and stuff, 100 gigabytes is probably going to be pretty... is probably going to do you, and so that much for $5 a month is an awfully good solution. Now there is going to be a lot of conversation about the licensing. Google has said that they've made it very clear in the license that everything that you own is yours, but they have the right to use it. In other words, not to use it to share with others, but to use it to look at it in order to sell to you better. So I think people are going to have some privacy issues with it,
because
they're also taking advantage of some of their image recognition technology. So if you put up photos that have the Eiffel Tower, they'll actually figure out that you were taking pictures in France from those photos.
Right.
And that sort of thing. So they've got that, as well as optical character recognition that's going to decipher any scanned images that you have. So Google wants to, they're going to be kind of poking around in your stuff.
Yeah, and I mean, if you're concerned about that, well, then you have other options, and you know, you have to look at that. But it's all anonymous data too, I would expect. So it's really just helping them to understand how to better, you know, market to people that they're trying to market to, and the people that do business with them, I guess, is really the thinking. So, yeah.
Nevertheless, it will be an interesting conversation as we move ahead.
Absolutely.
And heaven forbid that Google makes a mistake and does something, you know, a little bit egregious with it. And
yes.
And then we'll be off to the races with a lot of controversy. But for now, it is certainly looks like it's going to be. I'm not sure it will take over for Dropbox completely, because Dropbox is so ingrained. I'm a little bit surprised that you didn't jump on the Dropbox bandwagon.
I used a USB stick, and I've done that for, oh my goodness,
but how did you
years.
Get documents into your iPad? Did you just email them to yourself?
Well, that was one way, but interestingly enough, you know, not that often did I have to read anything or edit anything much on my iPad. I just didn't really have a call for that. It was more on, you know, if I wanted to edit a PowerPoint, I tended to do that on my laptop anyway. So It has a USB slot. So I looked at more content. So you're right. I would just email it to myself if I really had to bring it
and
with me.
And that allows you to open it. Well, here's where, like, Dropbox for me has become essential, because I am trying to, I've started on my master's. And I am trying to be paperless for my entire master's. I realize that might be a bit of a pipe dream. So I'm using Dropbox as a holding place for all of the PDF documents that I have to read, because I have lots and lots of papers that I have to read, and I have to mark up, and I'm marking them up in a PDF annotation program.
Right.
But the only way to open these in on your iPad, you can't just import them directly, is to either email them to yourself and then open them, but then you don't have them stored in a common location.
Right.
Dropbox will allow you to open them and then save them back. So Dropbox becomes the virtual drive for the iPad for all of the documents that I'm working on.
So when Google delivers the software to do that on the iPad, then they really do have a horse race going on.
I will take a good close look at it, because I quite like using Google Docs for my writing. And so it might be even a more elegant solution for me, because it'll be integrated with the actual docs for the writing, and I don't have to worry about writing in a browser, or just in the kind of more open form with Google Docs, which isn't all that elegant a way for doing writing. Normally, what I'm doing is I'm just using the notepad, writing in the notes, and then I'm migrating the content over afterwards, which is not a preferred solution.
Yeah, you know, it's all about simplicity and flexibility, right? Yeah. And what you're comfortable with. So I would expect, as I said, it's going to be a horse race between these two big guys. And
they've priced themselves
just
under Dropbox's pricing.
Right, right. So, you know, price matters to most folks. Yeah. So that's certainly something to consider, right?
It's too bad for the SugarSync guys, because I like them best. Of all the ones that I've used, I think SugarSync is awesome because of the way that it syncs, and the management utility that allows you to choose what folders that you want to sync, and then how easy it was to migrate from one to the other. And they've all got, well, certainly Dropbox and SugarSync. I don't know if Google will, but everybody who you recommend that signs up, they give you a little bit extra storage. So I've built up to a fair bit of storage now in SugarSync as a result of my recommendations.
Right.
Yeah. So that's
neat way to promote it, yeah.
Well, it is. You know, you get an extra 250 megabytes every time somebody signs up, so you're out there proselytizing for them to a certain extent.
Now, it's all good.
Let's wrap things up by saying you told me by email that you're seeing very clearly now, and that you've had a bit of an eye-opening experience in the purchase of your last set of glasses.
Yes, I you know, I was looking at glasses because it was time to replace mine, and well, basically, in the past, I've spent, you know, hundreds and hundreds of dollars. In fact, my last pair, I think, was over $1,000, right? They had to cut the lenses in Germany. They were bifocals. So I decided I'm going to go and do the online thing, and started looking into Clearly Contacts. And
good Canadian company.
Absolutely. I believe they're based in Richmond. And
I think they have some facilities in Richmond. Their offices are all in Burnaby, or just, in Vancouver, near Burnaby.
There you go. So, yeah, I followed their process, which is really simple. You can actually take a picture of yourself and import it into the website, and then you can try on all these different glasses. The hardest part really is just measuring, and understanding what you need to measure. And the most critical thing is actually measuring the distance between your pupils. And if you can get someone else to do that, I had my son help me, did it several times to verify it, and I'm like 68.5 millimeters, right? So that's a critical number on the order form. You put that in, and
that's the most important one, because that's what they measure at the optometrist when they're sitting in your glasses. Now, when you go for your eye appointment, you just now, I do it. I asked my optometrist or my ophthalmologist, I said, can I have my PD on the prescription?
And I should have done that, but I didn't realize I was going to go down this path.
Yeah.
The next
but
time.
But you will next time, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. The PD number is pupil distance is what that stands for.
And then with your picture, you can actually put the glasses on top of your face and then see how they're going to look.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a cool process. I'm not sure I'm 100% down with it, but I found, and we did a nice feature on them early on with the show, and I love the e-commerce model that they've put in, the way that they're putting things together and how they're building and how aggressive they've been.
Yes.
But I find their website overwhelming with the number of choices of frames.
There are ways to limit that. If you put in, the distance of the lens, like the size it is, and you put in a couple of additional parameters, it really selects, less glasses for you. So it's a little easier to choose, because you're correct. There's an awful lot of choices there, which is great. It's just a little bit overwhelming if you're not sure what you're looking for to start with.
Now,
I kind of had an idea, so it was a little easier for me.
Did you use, they have an online agent that you can chat with as you're doing your order. Did you use that feature?
No, I didn't, but I did actually call customer service, because when I initially ordered them, there was a slight delay in one pair, and mm-hmm. I called them, and awesome customer service, by the way, just fantastic, as good as I've ever experienced. So, that's a kudos for the folks at Clearly Contacts and what they're doing.
They get social media, too. If you are the person that needs glasses, or somebody in your family does, which who doesn't, it's well worth your time to like them on Facebook, because they send through offers occasionally that are just ridiculous as far as, the amount of money that you can save on some of their specials.
Well, their first pair, if you order a basic set, is actually free. They'll give you the first set for free, because they're assuming you're going to buy more. And the pricing is incredibly aggressive. And, like Trevor Linden, the spokesperson for them, said, you never understood why glasses were so expensive. Neither did I. But this is such a great option for people. And, yeah.
It's a great example of e-commerce working for all of us. Paul DeMera, thanks so much for your time, and we'll talk to you hopefully next week.
Always enjoy chatting, Steve.
Have a good one.
Cheers.
Joining me online now, my Mac guru, Rick Yeager from AppMan.tv. How are you doing, Rick?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm infected with some kind of Trojan, though. So
no, did you get? You didn't really, did you?
Well, I got it. I work at an office, so if somebody in the office gets it, it becomes my problem.
Oh, so somebody else got. Now, this is, of course, the first major virus to hit the Mac world. So we're all akimbo over the fact that, gosh darn it, Macs can get infected by viruses. This cannot be.
It's kind of weird, because it makes me feel like we're legitimized by this now. That
we
can play with the cool kids.
You know what's interesting is everybody used to talk about how secure the Macs were. And I used to think, yeah, but the thing is, with 6% or 3% or 4% market share, nobody cared about writing viruses for Mac.
Yeah, and that's kind of the market right now.
Yeah.
The market for viruses is no longer what it used to be in the late 90s, where some script kiddie, as they were called back then, would just do it so that he could snicker about it to his friends that I infected a bunch of people. They do it now for profit, and if there's no profit in it, they don't do it. So,
it's become a business. At least if you're getting infected now, there's a legitimate reason. It's not just somebody. It's not just basically somebody being a jerk.
Yeah. Well, it is somebody being a jerk, but it's somebody being a jerk for money, which just makes it all the worse for you, because somehow they're finding a way to get money out of you.
So how are they different than the banks?
that's a topic for another show.
Okay, not that I'm bitter. Okay,
no.
But and here's the thing. Now, Macs, the reason that there's targets is because their market share is exploding as well.
Yeah.
I was in Starbucks today, and I looked at a row of people on computers, and there were 8 people with computers, notebooks out, in this Starbucks, there was one PC. All the rest were Macs.
Were those glowing, obnoxious Apple logos.
But it was, they all had better Macs than me, too. And there I was on my sad little iPad. But holy cow. I mean, I just, it, you know, as I looked, and today it was, it just kind of came home to roost. I can remember back when I sold Macs and stuff, and I was just, you know, we were happy to get to 10% market share. And now, you know, and they're still, they cost, what, 2 to 3 times as much as PCs. It's amazing. So
it's not like they become less expensive. They just become more popular.
Yeah, well, that's the Apple magic. So let's talk about the Flashback Trojan. What will it do? What are the characteristics of the Flashback?
Well, it is the first, you know, major virus for the Mac, and it does what's called a drive-by download, which means you don't even have to click anything. You just have to visit one of these malicious or unfortunately infected websites, and it will take advantage of a Java vulnerability and just download itself right onto your computer.
Okay.
That's it. It just happens. You don't know what's happening.
Are these sites the typical bad areas that people shouldn't be hanging out in anyways, the bad porn sites, that sort of stuff?
Most likely, it's hard to know at this point where it's hiding and what sites have been infected. I haven't heard of any particular site that's, you know, been pointed out.
Well, I'm hearing that it's being found in WordPress blog sites. So
for sure,
that means that it can be almost anywhere because everybody uses WordPress.
Yep. And since it doesn't ask for your username and password to install, but it does. It just doesn't need to.
Wow.
It installs the bulk of its payload without even asking you a single question, and then just so that it can install some nastier things even deeper into your system, it does ask for a username and password. And if you're not fooled by that, it doesn't matter. It's still infected you.
Okay. So what is it going to do to me?
What it's going to do is it's going to inject itself into Safari. And it seems like Microsoft Office as well. And it appears to harvest information. Like it's going to watch what you do as far as web browsing activities. And it's going to take a particular note of your username and passwords on various sites, probably banking ones.
Ooh.
And then it sends that information back home to, who knows, we're guessing Russia, but Russia is just an easy target to blame for all viruses these days.
This is not a virus that's going to slow our computer down. It's not a denial of service attack. It's not attacking anybody other than it's trying to steal our information.
Yeah.
The scariest type.
Exactly. I mean, it actually doesn't want your computer to slow down because it wants you to continue using it.
You want to have no sign. It wants to be a silent assassin. How do we find out if we have it?
It can be determined if you can go into terminal. There's a few sites that have published this terminal command that you can copy and paste into your terminal window, and it'll let you know if certain files that it downloads and installs into your system are present. And then there are other terminal commands you can use to get rid of them. But at this point, it's easy enough to just update Java, which is where the vulnerability is found anyway.
Will updating Java delete it?
That I couldn't determine. I got rid of that. I told you somebody at the office got it.
Yeah.
But I use the terminal commands to get rid of it. I'm going to publish those on I'm going to publish those on macmerc.com. My other site, just so that the listeners can copy and paste those with ease. So
with terminal, it's just basically a line command that you can just do a search for terminal in on your Mac, and then it opens up this little dialog box. You just copy and paste the text that you put in and hit enter.
Hit enter, and if it says this file is not present, that's great. It hasn't downloaded that file, so you're safe. Mm-hmm. And then you can check for the other files, and hopefully they're not present either.
Okay.
And if you've gotten through all that, nothing's been installed, the best course of action is to make sure you've got You're running the most up-to-date version of Java for Lion and Snow Leopard. Unfortunately, there's no update further back than that.
Okay. Now, I see a couple of apps like Flashback Checker that's available. That looks like the sort of thing that just is a self-running terminal app. Is that right?
I haven't checked that one, but okay. There's a few helpful people out there that have come out with applications to check for this virus. The cool thing about the virus is that it checked to see if you were running antivirus software, if you had Xcode installed, or if you were running Little Snitch. And if you were doing any of those things, it just went away. It just figured you were too smart for it, and it was almost like it saw the sticker in the window of your front door that said you had an alarm system, and that's enough. I'll go knock on someone else's door.
Oh, so if you were running antivirus, it decided that
it didn't even try.
Wow.
Well, that's the nasty thing about viruses is I'm saying that now, but that's the information I got yesterday while I was researching. By today, that might not be true. So the new variant, if there is a new variant, the best course of action is to just patch Java and make sure that you're running the most recent version of it.
Well, I've just, while we've been talking, I found the little script online. I just ran it, and it came back saying my machine is clear. But it was quite simple to do. But, wow, it's scary.
Yeah, and it's Java. I mean, I don't know. When was the last time you used Java?
I guess it's always running with something, isn't it?
It doesn't actually install with the operating system on Macs anymore. It installs the first time you need it.
Yeah.
And most often that's when you're doing some kind of almost one of those conference call chat software that's within the browser. It'll be a Java app, but for the most part, it's not really there unless you've used something with Java in it.
Mm-hmm.
So to prevent, I mean, get Little Snitch. It's a good piece of software to run anyway. It lets you know when software, good, bad, or other, is phoning home.
Little Snitch. I haven't seen that one before. So it's a little app that you install that just basically watches for things that are going to
that are calling home, that are sending information back. Like it's not going to alert you when you send an email. That's obvious. But if you launch an application that suddenly sends information back to the developer, it'll let you know, and you can say yes or no to that. And most times it's fine.
It's fairly benign, because most of the social media apps that we work with want to be able to go back and forth and be able to talk, and they're sending location Precisely. Information or other things, which you've already given permission to, but they are going to be doing that.
Yes.
Yeah.
So if you don't need Java, I'd get rid of it.
Mm-hmm.
If you do need it, update it.
And the easiest way to update Java is?
Run software update.
Okay, and that'll just do it.
That'll just do it. If there's an update available, it'll come up there. Mm-hmm. Turn off Java on your web browsers.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, uninstall Flash would also help.
That'll make Steve happy in his grave.
Yes. And you can still access a lot of Flash content if you're using Google Chrome, because it has almost has Flash built in and sandboxed in.
Okay.
So if you really need it, you can run Google Chrome.
And it has become my browser of preference.
Oh, really? Okay.
Mm-hmm. What about you?
I'm still on Safari just because everyone asks. Anybody who's has like tech support questions, they seem to be running Safari. I need to keep up with its quirks.
Yeah. Well, I keep a Safari session running all the time because I have two different Google accounts that I need to have operating. I have one for the show and one for my personal life. And I don't like the dual login idea for Google, for the for your Gmail accounts and stuff like that. So I keep two sessions running by having two different browsers, one in Safari, one in so I do all my business stuff in Safari and all my personal stuff and the communication stuff in Chrome. It's elegant. It's me.
Yeah, well, I might try that, actually. I have the same problem.
There you go. Well, listen, Rick, thank you so much for the information. We will certainly post a link in on our site to the document that you put on MacMerk. And for all of our Mac users out there, this is something that you should be definitely paying attention to.
Yes.
Thank you very much. That's Rick Yeager with, I guess we'll say MacMerk.com this time, right?
Okay, yeah.
Okay. Thanks for your time,
Steve.
Rick.
Thanks, Steve.
What a lineup we had for this week's show. Merlin Horton, Rick Yeager, and, of course, Paul DeMera. Now, as we mentioned during Paul's segment, we are giving away a Slingbox on the site. So if you drop by dottotech.com there, you can enter to win a Slingbox HD, which we will be giving away sometime next week. So keep your eye on your inbox, and maybe you'll be the lucky winner of a Slingbox HD. Our special thanks to the companies that support us so well. Mac Station and London Drugs out here in the Vancouver area do a tremendous job of helping us out here on Dotto Tech. And of course, I need to thank all of you loyal listeners who tune in each week to hear what we have to say. Without you, I guess we wouldn't have anything to do. Well, we're looking forward to seeing you again next week right here on Dotto Tech.